Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Paul A. Lombardo to discuss his book, Three Generations, No Imbeciles, Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell, originally published in 2008 by Johns Hopkins University Press and updated given contemporary events in reproductive politics in 2022. Three generations of imbeciles are not enough were the infamous words U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. wrote in 1927. In Buck v. Bell, an almost unanimous court upheld a Virginia law allowing the sterilization of people the state found to be, quote, socially inadequate and, quote, feeble-minded. This landmark decision allowed the eugenics movement to take full effect with multiple states passing similar laws. In Three Generations, No Imbeciles, Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell, Dr. Paul Lombardo unpacks the case of an individual, Carrie Buck, to argue that the case not only represents the collective power of the eugenics movement in the early 20th century, but an individual miscarriage of justice. Using extensive archival sources, Dr. Lombardo demonstrates that Carrie Buck was neither a, quote, moral degenerate or, quote, feeble-minded. She was a rape victim of sound mind. The powerful eugenics lobby manufactured a case, and a sympathetic court gave them a precedent that justified Carrie Buck's sterilization and over 60,000 sterilizations in the following decades. Three Generations, No Imbeciles frames the history of sterilization as essential to understanding contemporary legal fights over birth control and abortion. Does the Constitution's promise of liberty include the right to become pregnant or end a pregnancy? Dr. Lombardo's epilogue and afterword outlines the connections between Buck and modern cases involving abortion, disability rights, and reparations for those sterilized. Dr. Paul A. Lombardo is Regents Professor and Bobby Lee Cook Professor of Law at the Center for Law, Health, and Society at Georgia State University. He's published extensively on topics in health law, medical legal history, and bioethics, and is best known for his work on the legal history of the American eugenics movement. I am delighted to welcome him to New Books in Political Science.
Thank you, Susan.
So I've been talking to a lot of people about your book, and many have actually never heard of this famous Supreme Court case. So let's start with what we'd know about this individual, Carrie Buck, if we had just read the extremely short 1927 decision by Oliver Wendell Holmes in Buck v. Bell.
Well, we don't know very much about Carrie Buck. We know that she was a young woman. By the time she got to the court, she was, by the time she went to trial, she was 17. There was a trial in Amherst County, which happened in 1924. So by the time she got to the Supreme Court, she was, 20 years old. She never went to the Supreme Court, of course. So the papers that followed her case went there. The justices themselves never saw her or met her. And they describe her as a poor white woman. And they pick up the language, really the language from people who testified in her case, and people who sent information in, the doctors primarily who had examined her. And she is called a feeble-minded white woman who was committed to the state colony. That's an institution in Amherst County, Virginia. She's the daughter of a feeble-minded mother, the mother of an illegitimate feeble-minded child, 18 years old, it says here, at the time of the trial, in 1924. So she had just turned 18. We don't really know much else about her. If you just read the opinion, we hear a description of, again, the testimony in the case, but relatively little about the kind of person she was or anything really about her life.
So as you note in the book, you know, Buck Feebell was about her, but not really about her. It was motivated by wider movements in the United States and the progressive movement with regard to eugenics. So can you tell us a little bit about how eugenics and the eugenics movement was the backdrop for this case about this one individual woman from Virginia who the court never saw?
Yes, you raise an important point about the backdrop of the case, and that is that this is really a book. I've been asked, who is the main character in this book? Is it Carrie Buck? And to me, I would have liked to have written more about Carrie Buck. I wrote everything that I could find and everything that she told me, but I didn't really have the kind of detail that you'd like to have for a biography. And some people wanted a biography, and I said, well, it's not the Carrie Buck story. The main character in this story is the case and how it comes to be and how it fits into the history of the American eugenics movement and the larger history of the rights of reproduction in this country. So the backdrop is this. There's a enormously well-known and well-discussed history of eugenics. And I'm not talking about what was done by scholars. I'm talking about at the time. At the time of the Buck case, it is possible now to research this by using, you know, all the sources that are digitized, newspapers, magazines, and things like that, and say without really any question that if you were a person who went to school, add on to that maybe a person who read a newspaper every now and then, you would have heard the word eugenics, and you might have had a variety of things that you thought about it. You might have thought that it was something that was quite fascinating and exciting because it was the sort of thing that people were so used to hearing connected to health, connected to science, connected to medicine, that there were even advertisements in the newspapers. The eugenic corn was sold, eugenic pharmaceuticals, eugenic baby carriages, even eugenic motor cars. People understood this word to have a kind of positive significance in many ways because it was connected to health and what they called hygiene and clean living. You might also have heard that people were very afraid, and they used the word eugenics to signal many of their fears. They were afraid of all of the immigrants coming over from Europe, particularly at the time of Carrie Buck's childhood. The United States had passed an Immigration Restriction Act in 1924, the very year that this case comes to trial. They were afraid of people who were different, who seemed to be filling the institutions in the country, making taxes go up, hospitals and asylums and jails and homes for, like the one that Carrie went to, the homes for the feeble-minded and the epileptic, as they were called. So you would have also not only had this positive notion about eugenics, you would have had a very negative one that traced it to all of the problems of society, crime and poverty and disease and rampant immigration of strange people who spoke strange languages and looked different. People who were swarthy Mediterraneans or Jews from Eastern Europe. These are the people that the federal law was meant to keep out of the country. And so you would have known if you were a reader that eugenics was connected to those things too. Eugenics was the way of changing those trends and getting rid of those kinds of people who may have been scary to you. So the context for this is a lot of knowledge that people had when they went to school. They would, in many, many cases, have read, if they went through high school, they would have read textbooks that included commentary about eugenics, textbooks that told them that heredity was something that was biological, something that you could predict, something that you could use to trace all these terrible things that were happening in society. And they would have read about the families that were supposedly the fountain of this kind of problem, this model families, models not in the good sense, models in the worst sense, models like the Jukes, 19th century book, which almost everybody heard of. It was something that was certainly in the textbooks and biology textbooks or even history textbooks. So eugenics was not a strange notion to most people in the early 20th century, and it was a notion that they might have encountered not just in school, but certainly in popular literature, and even in their religious lives. They would have heard sermons about eugenics. They would have heard how many preachers connected this to social decline. This was something that, as preachers said, was borne out through the Bible verse that said that the sins of the father will be descended to the sons unto the third generation. And that verse was often used to signal the kinds of concerns people had about eugenics. Just as on the other side, there were the famous fitter family contests at state fairs and county fairs even, and the winners would receive a medal that had a Bible verse in it from the book of Psalms, "Yea, I have a goodly heritage." So Buck happens in the middle of this very, very large amount of attention to heredity among a generation of people who primarily grew up on the farm. So they understood heredity. They knew about the cows and the horses and the birds and the bees. They knew that characteristics of one generation often passed down to the others biologically, and that this could be a concern.
And in the book, you underline that this idea of social decline also involves sexuality and discomfort with sexuality, and that impacts how Carrie Buck is talked about in some of the documents as well. Can you say just a little bit more about how, in addition to concerns about, you know, who will take up tax dollars, that sexuality has, as well as fear of immigration and the underlying racism?
Yeah, I'm often asked if I can boil down eugenics into some small soundbite, and it's not easy to do because it meant a lot of different things. But what I come up with is eugenics was about sex, and it was about money. The money part really has to do with the cost of social problems. As I said, crime, poverty, disease, those are things fill institutions. Those things require you to, you know, put up barriers to people's entry into society. And those people eventually mean your tax dollars go up. So that's the money part. And that was very clearly a motive to people in the eugenics movement. They talked about it all the time. Sex is the other part. And when I say sex, I say that in the most broad sense, to signal not just sexuality, but certainly gender issues as well. The very first eugenic sterilization laws in places like Indiana, California, and Washington focused on people who could be charged with engaging in illegal or unconventional sexual practices. Obvious criminal practices like rape, but less obvious practices like same-sex relationships, even something like masturbation. That was the focus of the Indiana law in the very first case. And so anything that had to do with sexuality, what the eugenists often discussed as breeding more generally, anything that had to do with sex was likely to be a target of people in the eugenics movement. And we have to remember that at the time, this is the most active time between 1900 and 1930, of people like Anthony Comstock, who wants to rid America of anything that, as he said, reeked of lust. Meaning anybody talking about, writing about, publishing books about, or otherwise being engaged in something having to do with sex. Comstock says that lust is the cause of all criminality. And so he's able to get a federal law passed, and many states pass similar laws saying you can't talk about this stuff. We don't want it in the schools. We don't want it in the books. We certainly don't want it in the mails.
And we're recording this on a day when actually many Americans are waiting for the Supreme Court to, in fact, rule on the Comstock Act, which is still on the books and still potentially affecting the ability to mail birth control in the United States. Stay tuned on that. And we've done a podcast on the Comstock Act, which is also available in the archive. Paul, you said that this was something that was everywhere. It was in newspapers. It was something that people learned about and educated. You didn't have to be that educated, but we had some very educated people on the Supreme Court. We have Chief Justice Taft, who had been president previously, and we have Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, considered to be by many people one of the, you know, tallest intellects that had been on the Supreme Court by the late 20s. The language in this decision is very harsh. It was written by Oliver Wendell Holmes. He said, for example, and I'm just quoting from the case, it is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind, close quote. And so, can you tell us a little bit about how Holmes came to write this decision and how it was possible for eight people to sign on to this extremely sharp language?
Well, Holmes, of course, is the darling of the Supreme Court at the time of the Buck opinion. He has appeared only a short time before this on the cover of Time magazine when he moves into his 80s. He's the oldest person on the court, the longest serving person on the court at the time. And he is from a famous family. His father, of the same name, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., is a physician who teaches at Harvard Medical School, who is a scientist who's written really extraordinary articles in the scientific realm about how you need to be clean when you do surgery. This was a new idea in the 19th century, how you needed to wash your hands and use antiseptic techniques. And this is a way of avoiding the death of mothers who became infected during childbirth. He also happens to be, I hesitate to say on the side because it was hard to tell what he was doing more of, but he also happens to be a famous author. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who writes novels, he writes poems, he writes essays. He's writes in the North American Review constantly. He is known as the author of a couple poems to school children back years ago, when some of us were much younger, used to have to memorize. The One Horse Shay is a famous one, but he also writes about the famous ship in Boston Harbor, the Constitution, it's Old Ironsides. So the Holmes Sr. is famous, and he's also well known for saying things like, the way to improve society is by to pick better grandparents. So he's very much concerned about this idea of heredity, and he writes about it. And of course, his son, Oliver Jr., Wendell, I believe they called him at home, was a good study. And when he came down to breakfast every morning, his father is reputed to have said, say something clever. If he said something clever, he got an extra dose of marmalade. Well, the Buck opinion is a great example of Holmes trying to say something clever. He's known, he was called at the time the Yankee come down from Olympus. He's known for his phrase making. He's known as the person who who writes things like you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, or you can't really regulate the First Amendment unless there's a clear and present danger. So he's someone who people look to for the soundbite of the era. And in the Buck case, he gives them a soundbite. He says, three generations of imbeciles are enough. Now, there have been a few libraries full of books written about the Buck case. Well, I'm convinced that most of what happened in that opinion was not original to Holmes. The phrases that he uses pop up all over the place, this business of manifestly unfit, the idea that you had to have generation after generation of problems in order to trace heredity. I think he borrows those from other people who write about it, particularly a man named J. Ewing Mears, who was a surgeon and an ardent supporter of sterilization, who actually died earlier than the Buck opinion. So Holmes is a voracious reader. He knows what the eugenics movement is saying. He's very much in favor of it. We know that from his letters. And he captures this in a really, really short, only three-page opinion. Holmes is on the court at the same time, of course, as Chief Justice Taft. Taft, after being president, really wanted to be a judge, and he gets that wish when he's appointed to the Supreme Court. And he goes to Holmes to give him this opinion writing task with a fair amount of frustration, because he's having an administrator's problem of getting work back quickly. And he gives assignments to the other justices, and they sit on them for weeks, sometimes months. And Taft tells his wife about this when he writes home every other day. And he says, well, and I gave this opinion to Holmes, and he gave it back to me over a weekend. Basically just took the weekend and dashed it off. He's great. He's older than all the rest of them, but he's still a better writer and he's still a better worker. So he praises Holmes. Holmes, for his own sake, writes to one of his friends and lets them know that he got a fair amount of pushback from his colleagues about how harsh this opinion was. But he says, after all, in the end, they have to allow a man to say what he thinks. So Holmes is very proud of the opinion. And it becomes really the rallying cry that quiets many, if not most, of the critics of eugenic sterilization then in 1927.
Before we turn to how egregiously wrong much of what Holmes says in the opinion is, both in terms of Carrie Buck's own situation and eugenics, and also how due process is violated every step, I just want to talk about how you came to write this book, because it's a great story. It wasn't something that came from earlier research. You were reading a modern newspaper. So can you just recall that for everybody?
Yes, I'm very attached to newspapers, have been most of my adult life, most of my reading life, really. And actually, I spent the Watergate summer, the summer that Richard Nixon resigned, writing for a local newspaper in Chicago. So I've always been fairly attuned to what goes on in papers, and I spend a lot of time now reading old newspapers, so it's part of the historical research. But at the time, I was a graduate student, and you know, invention is, of course, the mother, or necessity is the mother of invention. I had to write a seminar paper, and I just happened to be having breakfast in a little cafe where somebody left the local paper behind, and there was an article there about a woman who'd been sterilized, and the headline said something about the fact that she couldn't have any babies. They took away her right to have babies, and when I read the article, I said, wow, I'd never heard of that. I had no idea what it was about. And why was it in the local paper? Well, it was in the local paper because the woman was from the local area. And she was named Doris Buck. The name didn't mean anything to me at the time. But as I read further, I realized she was the sister of the then infamous person, Carrie Buck, whose Supreme Court case had been decided and who also happened to be living in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I was going to school. So I used that article as the jumping off point for doing research about the case. thinking I might be able to get a seminar paper out of it, and I did. But what I found along the way was that not only was Charlottesville the place where Carrie Buck was from and where her case really began, but it was the place where the lawyer who brought this suit and took it to the Supreme Court had gone to school. When he died, he was a judge. He left all of his papers at the University of Virginia, and they were sitting there in the library basement, virtually untouched. They hadn't been numbered. There were more than 160 boxes of material when I got to them, and I had to put numbers on them because nobody had really gone through them systematically. So this became for me just not just the paper, but obviously a lot more. And I eventually made it the subject of my doctoral dissertation, tracing the life of this lawyer who became not just a lawyer, but then a legislator and then a judge, and how he had put this case together in support of the institution, the Virginia Colony for the Epileptic and the Feeble-Minded, which he had helped to found. So it was largely chance that I happened to have my eggs and bacon that morning in that place, and even more fortunate for me that I was just in the right place where many of the records that were indispensable to the study were stored.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's talk about the documents and the story that they ended up telling you about Carrie Buck's situation. The opinion assumes, as you say, that she is a poor white woman and that she's quote unquote feeble-minded and that her child is feeble-minded and that her mother is also feeble-minded. But the documents that you looked at really told a very, very different story about her. And also, we assume that lawyers act in defense of their clients. That is one of the assumptions of rule of law and the idea of putting two lawyers who will combat with their ideas and defend each side. But that actually isn't what happened, as you show in the book in this case. So tell us a little bit about these documents, what they show about who she was and how it was different from Holmes's depiction of her. And then we'll talk a little bit about how her case was handled by her attorney.
Well, my starting point, once I got into the Aubrey Strode documents, Strode was the lawyer for the hospital in this case, for the asylum, I started reading state reports. These were public reports. These were not private. They were written every year for the legislature to report on what had happened in state institutions. And what I was surprised by was that if I read reports from each of the state mental hospitals in Virginia, the rhetoric just got more and more dramatic. How terrible it was that these institutions were being filled with loose women who had been picked up in the red light districts in the cities, who were luring soldiers and sailors on the seacoast before they went overseas for the First World War, who were infecting them with diseases, and who were having children then who were like them, unable to control themselves and feeble-minded. So this is the language that's in state reports written by doctors. The lawyer for the hospital was asked several times to change the law and make it easier to commit people to these institutions. And he did that. That's Aubrey Strode. He's asked eventually to write a sterilization law, and he hesitates for a bit, and then he's contacted by people in New York at the Eugenics Record Office, who tell him that they've discovered a case. He hears about the case actually even earlier from the doctor who is his client, a man named Albert Priddy. And Dr. Priddy tells him he's about to put someone in the hospital who is the mother of a feeble-minded child. And her mother, the grandmother, is also in the institution. All this information goes to lots of people at the same time, including the people at the Eugenics Record Office, who say, my goodness, we've been studying this stuff for decades. We've never seen three generations all of the same family. It's a perfect case. So Strode builds his case around the assertion that they have three generations, clearly hereditary moral degeneracy, he says. They're all women. They're all unchaste. This is the same story that we've seen in The Jukes from the 19th century, or the other book that everybody read, The Kallikaks, written by a famous psychologist named Goddard. And this is what happens when women who are feeble-minded are allowed to roam in society. They get pregnant, they have babies, they fill up the institutions and the welfare rolls even more. So that's the plaintiff side. Perfect case, three generations, all fallen women, or at least potentially fallen in the case of the baby. The real driver in this case, though, is not the lawyer. It's the doctor. It's Dr. Albert Priddy. And Dr. Priddy is a man who is very well connected politically. He's actually served in the state legislature. He is constantly in touch with people who represent his district because they've helped him build the institution in which his own portrait hangs. He is the founder of the Virginia Colony for the epileptic and feeble-minded. And his real mission, he is a kind of local Anthony Comstock. He is a person who is obsessed with the idea that people are out there having sex and they aren't married and they are going to be on the welfare rolls. And so he tries very hard to work with local welfare officials, particularly in the big cities like Richmond, in getting more women off the streets. And he pushes a little too hard in one case and has some people arrested and brought to his institution, and he sterilizes them. There's no law that allows this. He just does it. And he gets sued for that. And he is so angry because he has had to commute on the train, even in his buckboard, to Richmond to be at trial, to be accused of assaulting someone surgically. And he's furious about this. He doesn't lose the case, but he's warned by the judge, don't do this again until you have a law that lets you. So he goes to his lawyer and says, I need a law that will protect me because I want to sterilize people. And that's where the Virginia law comes from. It's a way of immunizing this doctor and his colleagues who want to sterilize people in institutions. And so when the case finally appears, Cary Buck being the lead character here as the then pregnant daughter of a woman who was in a state institution, and herself is, according to the plaintiff's arguments, obviously a morally degenerate person because she's not married and she's pregnant. The baby is born. The baby is examined. They're not quite sure what to make of this child. Something not quite right, says the Red Cross nurse. Something peculiar, says the eugenics expert. But that's about as far as they go. But that's enough. Because that's enough for Dr. Priddy to say, I've got three generations here. Let's make a case out of this. And so they look around for a lawyer. Mr. Strode is asked by his board to find some competent lawyer who will represent the defendant in this case, Cary Buck. And so Cary Buck is, these terms, plaintiff and defendant, shift depending on what level of the case you're at. So sometimes she's called the plaintiff because she's actually suing the state. Other times she's the defendant because she's the one who's going to be sterilized. So in any event, Cary Buck is the person who is slated for sterilization. Strode says, I've got the perfect person. Irving Whitehead. Well, everybody knows Irving Whitehead. He's a lawyer who works at a bank in Baltimore, commutes back and forth to his home in Virginia. He's been a lawyer for many years, has lots of experience. And so he is named to represent Carrie Buck. And he is paid, as is Strode, the going rate, paid quite handsomely for his work in defending this young lady.
But he doesn't really defend her, as you outline in the book, because he doesn't seem to be thinking about how to stop her from being sterilized, and he continues to have conversations with the other side. Can you outline just a little bit about how this sort of doesn't follow the normal patterns of two attorneys who are supposed to be facing off in a courtroom?
Well, Strode is a very meticulous lawyer, and he writes up extremely detailed briefs and presents a lot of evidence in the case to have Carrie Buck sterilized. They're in the Amherst County Courthouse, and there in Virginia, Strode argues that he brings several lawyers. He deposes people and actually brings in an expert from the Eugenics Record Office in New York who testifies, saying that Carrie Buck is feeble-minded and so is her mother, and so it looks like is her daughter. And so she clearly fits into this language of someone who is socially inadequate and needs to be sterilized to protect the state from more of the same kind of people. And so Strode's case is very detailed. His counterpart, Irving Whitehead, however, doesn't seem to have done much real research at all. Strode presents something like 10 witnesses. Whitehead presents none. When information is brought in that any first-year law student would object to, saying that's either irrelevant or that's hearsay, you're quoting people who are not in the courtroom, Strode presents the information, then Whitehead lets it come in. He doesn't object. Whitehead seems a passive member of this defense team, and he's supposed to be leading it. The case is eventually decided at the trial court level in favor of the law, upholding the law, vindicating Dr. Priddy and his lawyer Strode. And Whitehead then goes to the meeting not with his client, Carrie Buck. We don't know if he even met Carrie Buck before the trial. There's no evidence that he visited her. There's no evidence that he did any real research for the case either. But after this case is already decided by a judge at the trial court, he then goes to the meeting of the State Board of Hospitals, where all the doctors who direct the state institutions are meeting, and he tells them this case is in great shape. He just lost. He says this case is in wonderful shape to go to the court of last resort, which of course is the United States Supreme Court. We could not have had a better result. So instead of going to his client, Carrie, and saying, I'm going to fight hard for you on appeal, or this is a bad result, but we're going to keep going, he goes to his opponents, no doubt with a smile on his face, and says, this is great. This is exactly where we want it to be. To me, this is the most clear mark of his betrayal of his client and the fraud that he perpetrated on the court. Now, if you go further into the records, you realize that this is not surprising, because Whitehead was a supporter of sterilization. After Dr. Priddy had been sued for sterilizing people without legal sanction, he writes a letter to Priddy saying, you did exactly the right thing. You know, we should sterilize more of these people. He had actually been on the board and voted in favor of the sterilizations, the illegal sterilizations that Dr. Priddy did. He was a member of the board of the institution. There's even a plaque on one of the buildings that has his name on it. So while the court knew that he was someone familiar, had been a member of the board, they were assured that this was an arm's length transaction. And none of this information came out until decades later.
There's sort of an interesting character in the book, which are sort of the Catholic press and the National Council of Catholic Men, where they seem, in fact, horrified by sterilization and do want to contribute to arguments, yet fearing backlash against Catholics who in this period are not accepted by everyone as equal citizens. They're acting in the background. Can you tell us a little bit about what they're up to and why they are so integral to this story?
Yes. There were, if you look at all the records of the case, of course, there are a lot. And I posted all of these on my website, buckvbell.com, so that people could actually see what happened in the case at the legal level. And not only do we have the transcript of the trial, but we have the briefs on appeal to the Virginia Court of Appeals, the Virginia Supreme Court. They uphold the law. Strode and Whitehead present briefs to them. Strode's is lengthy and detailed. Whitehead is cursory and very short. And then they go on after that to the United States Supreme Court with a similar kind of response. Whitehead puts a little more effort into this, but not much more. And then he receives a letter from a Catholic men's group, which had been tracking these sterilization cases over the years. And they get in touch with him and say, gosh, you missed a lot. You know, you didn't raise the most important questions. There are critics out there you could have cited. You might have even brought them in as witnesses, but you didn't do that. We'd like to help you form another brief for rehearing and ask the court for another shot at this. Whitehead, no doubt, is very embarrassed at this point because he was flying under the radar. No one had called him out on his poor performance. And so he tells them that he'll consider this, and he eventually does take their brief, which was written by them. He charges the colony and the state hospital board for his for producing the brief, another fraud. And then he files it in the Supreme Court. Of course, by then the court had already decided. And this was an after the fact, we might say, Hail Mary pass, in which it was pretty certain that he was going to lose. But he went through the motions anyway, and he did lose. The petition for rehearing was not granted. They rarely were. But in that brief, we have most of the arguments that he should have raised the first time around. There were several that he wouldn't put in the brief because it would have embarrassed him that he didn't raise those questions during the trial. So we do have in the background people who are paying a lot of attention. The church was consistently against, as a group, consistently against these laws over the time that they were passed. And of course, that all culminates with the papal encyclical, which says this explicitly after the Buck case.
There's one justice who dissents from the case, Pierce Butler, who is the only Catholic justice on the court at the time. He doesn't leave a dissent. Do we have any idea why as to he did not agree in Buck v. Bell, the only one?
Well, we only have speculation. We have a comment from Holmes who says, again in his correspondence to someone, oh, I bet he goes with the church, says Holmes. He didn't expect Butler to vote with him. If you do any research on Butler, he's an interesting character himself. He's one of the so-called four horsemen who was against everything in the New Deal and against a lot of the sort of experimental legislation that came out under Franklin Roosevelt. He votes in this case, without leaving an opinion, again, not unusual at the time. There weren't nearly as many long dissenting opinions then. And he didn't leave any comments about why. I know that years later, I had a conversation with Justice Blackmun. Justice Blackmun, of course, known as the author of Roe versus Wade. And Justice Blackmun said that when he was young, he would often go to formal banquets and such and meetings and Justice Butler would be the speaker, and he would be introduced, and they always made a joke out of it. They would say, according to Oliver Wendell Holmes, three generations of imbeciles are enough, but Justice Butler, our next speaker, dissents. And so Butler lived with that, and it's hard to know why he did it. Maybe his thoughts had to do with his beliefs about sterilization, and he was convinced by the various priests he had talked with. He also had a little skeleton in his own closet, which I write about in the book, which is he was the executor of his brother's estate. His brother was quite wealthy. And his brother had a child who was born by his housekeeper, to whom he was not married. And they went to great lengths to hide that. And when Justice Butler, when his brother died and he took over the administration of the estate, there was a very delicate business of paying off this woman who wanted her child to have a part in this estate. She didn't get it. So he was successful in keeping her away from the money that the brother had left. But this all was written up in the newspapers. And so there was a sort of mini scandal about it that related to Justice Butler. Did this have anything to do with the Buck case? I have no idea. There's no way to know. It's purely speculation either way as to why he voted the way he did.
You mentioned Justice Blackmun, author of Roe v. Wade, and one of, I think, the sort of geniuses elements of this book is that it is not only a history that places a very, very famous case in historical context, it's not only an amazing work of forensic history that reveals fraud, lies, and sort of the scandal of a sham case in favor of an individual woman who you actually end up interviewing shortly before she died. But the book also is arguing that these cases are relevant deeply to where we are now. You note, for example, that in Roe v. Wade, Justice Blackmun uses Buck v. Bell to justify the state's interest in third trimester fetuses and their lives. You say that it doesn't trump the power of a state to potentially issue a sterilization order of the kind affirmed in Buck. And you also cite elements of Casey that in which there is this recognition without naming that there's a similarity between the freedom to get pregnant and have a child versus to choose not to. You updated this book in 2022 for publication, and you do so much to sort of catch up on how it is that people have thought about Buck v. Bell, how they've related the ways in which it relates to abortion politics. But that was before SCOTUS decided Dobbs v. Jackson, women's health. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about how you see this case as essential to our understanding of the debates today over reproductive freedom and whether the Constitution in any way protects any sort of liberty with regard to pregnancy.
Well, I want to do that, but I think it's important to talk about a little bit the reason that the Buck case was such a fraud. I mentioned the role of Irving Whitehead. At the time that Roe versus Wade is written, Buck has not really been explicated the way it has been now by not just me, but many, many other scholars. And what brought me to focus so much on Buck was the fraud of the case, which was triggered by discovering several things almost at the same time. The first was the records of Carrie Buck as a student. She went to grade school through the sixth grade, I believe, in Charlottesville, Virginia, and she was taken out of school so that she could be basically the housekeeper for her foster parents. Her Greg Card said that she did just fine. Her deportment, her behavior was good. She did well in a couple subjects, not so well in others, mostly a basically average performance. Nothing that suggested that she was, as she had been accused of being, quote, mentally deficient, unquote. But the real find there was not Carrie's records, it was her daughter's records. Her daughter Vivian, who was born just before this case starts, just before the case goes to trial, Vivian is a baby. She is taken away from Carrie almost immediately. Carrie's picture shows her. This is a picture that I didn't discover until the almost the late 1990s. Carrie's picture shows her the day before the trial with her mother, with kind of a scowl on her face, and you realize she's just postpartum. She's just getting over having a baby taken away from her and then being snatched up and sent to this institution. So there's reason for her to not feel well. The baby is raised by the foster parents quite lovingly, I think. And they even gave her a middle name after her foster mother. And she's sent to the local school where she does, at least in the second grade, quite well. She's on the honor roll. She gets the measles then. She gets a secondary infection, and she dies at age 8. But she's on the honor roll. So clearly, there was nothing, quote, peculiar about her. The mother is okay. The daughter is okay. The grandmother is somebody who's sick, but still, at the time of her commitment, has managed to save up several hundred dollars, which is a real sum of money in those days. So she's not the wastrel, irresponsible person that they make her out to be. She may have had a problem with drugs, with prohibited substances. That's not clear. But the real takeaway is that the information presented to the court about Carrie Buck and her daughter certainly is false. And so this was something that could have been determined by some good lawyering on the part of Whitehead, which never occurred.
Even basic lawyering really is what I think you document in the book. And I think that that is the sort of most painful part about reading this book, is that this is not, oh my goodness, something really difficult was missed. It's that basics were missed and that there really was no attempt made to do two things. One, to do what was trying to be done by the Catholic men's group of lawyers, which is to make a principled case against the state's ability to sterilize people that it judges, in not a very rigorous process, to not be of value to society such that they shouldn't reproduce. So that's the principle. And the second, the individual. And as you say, and I really think it's an accurate, a lovely description of the book, this is a biography of a case, and cases always that come to the Supreme Court have to do with both an individual and a principal. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. And we always have to hold those two things in our hands. And I think what's brilliant about this book is the way in which it does both throughout. And therefore, by the time you take it to the present, we have both the tragedy of Carrie Buck, but we also have the tragedy of this precedent and its legacy, and the fact that the court hasn't actually worked out through those cases, Buck, Skinner, and others, the extent to which people have any liberty in their reproductive control.
I was criticized. I wrote my first law review article on this in 1985, and when it came out, there was some criticism from lawyers saying that I had second-guessed people who were long dead. I had not given them the benefit of the doubt. I had reached some conclusions that maybe weren't warranted. Well, I disagreed with that. And when I went back to write the book, I said, what would a lawyer have done? By then I was on the faculty at the same school, at the University of Virginia. And I said, what would a lawyer have done who had this case? And so I literally went to the place where the law school had been, which was adjacent to railroad tracks there in Charlottesville. And I walked from that place over to where Carrie Buck's house was, which took about maybe 10 minutes. And then I walked back and I pulled the books in the library that had been written and were available at the time the case occurred. And I went to my colleagues who were the law librarians and I said, how would I know whether these books were here? And they said, oh, well, we keep records of all that. They had an accession list. They went back to it. And they said, all of those books were here in 1924 when this case was heard. So any good lawyer, any competent lawyer, which was the description given for Irving Whitehead, would simply have gone to the most convenient library right there, pulled those books, easy to find, and read them, and then would have walked across the street, across the railroad tracks, and over to Carrie Buck's house and talked to her about what happened to her. They would have found out two things. They would have found out that, as we all learn in law school, first you've got to find what the facts are. And the facts are that Carrie Buck was somebody who was in two different church choirs. That was pretty good evidence that she wasn't the kind of girl they were describing. They would have also heard from her that she had been assaulted by the fellow who called himself her boyfriend, who then disappears, literally disappears from history. Never sure exactly what happened to him. I think he went off into the military, but that's not clear. So we have an assault, rape. We have somebody whose character is not what it's said to be. We have contradictory evidence by the witnesses. That's the facts of the case that were never explored. And then, assuming that the facts might not have carried the day, we go back and we attack the law, the principle. And that is attackable on lots of different levels, the scientific level being the easiest one. There's lots of people who originally said, well, we think this sterilization is a good thing, who later said, wait a minute, I'm a scientist. I'm at Johns Hopkins, as were people like Raymond Pearl and others. And I think this law doesn't work. Heredity doesn't work like that. We don't really know what your children are going to be like just because of the way you are. Now, the idea that people inherit everything directly from their parents is too simplistic. It doesn't even work that way. Thomas Hunt Morgan, the first person to win the Nobel Prize in genetics, says it doesn't even work that way in flies. How can we say it works that way in human beings? And so Irving Whitehead's failure to get at the facts or the law really leave us with a precedent that, as you say, is deficient and is infamous. What does the Supreme Court do with that? Well, from 1927 until 1942, they don't do much. They occasionally mention the case, usually approvingly. Justice Brandeis says, well, you know, we've decided this case. That's one, you know, that's one that's okay. In 1942, we've got a different question, and that is, can you sterilize people in prisons? And so after a lengthy foray, an attempt to sterilize people in Oklahoma's main prison in McAllister, a case gets to the Supreme Court and is decided in 1942 called Skinner versus Oklahoma. And the Skinner case says, no, we don't know enough about science. And we really don't want to give the state the power to make a crime and then say somebody will be sterilized because they're going to inherit the propensity for that crime. In reckless hands, one of the justices said, you could wipe out whole peoples, whole tribes, whole groups of people. And of course, he's referring to what's going on at the time in Germany with Hitler, who sterilizes close to 500,000, and many of them Jews. So the lesson of Skinner is, well, you got to be really careful with sterilization. But then they go back and say, you know, it's different with people who are feeble-minded, and they endorse Buck again. That case goes forward. It's not until the 1960s that the next major case comes up, and that's Griswold versus Connecticut. And that's a case which challenges the Comstock laws. It challenges those laws and the state laws that prohibit the distribution or the mailing or the use of birth control. And it overturns those laws, saying that you cannot interfere with these intimate personal decisions that happen within the family. It says the scope of government, Justice Douglas says, this is a right that precedes the Constitution. This is a right that is inherent in human life. We can't have the government intruding into people's bedrooms. We can't have the government deciding who can or cannot, who should or should not have children. And so the Skinner case essentially continues to go on in the is repeated as a support of the idea of a marital intimacy and human privacy in overturning of the birth control decisions in the 1960s. And that case is repeated in the Roe case as well. And as you've said, the Roe case says, well, we know that this right is not absolute. Most rights in the Constitution are not. And so the right of privacy we're talking about is not absolute. And it footnotes Buck there. It says, you know, we've decided that there's some things you can do. And so with a sort of side glance, it continues to assert that there is a certain amount of power in the judiciary, even in these intimate areas, in specific cases. So unless you understand the way that the reproductive rights cases fit together, particularly the eugenics cases, Buck case, the Skinner case, and the other case, which I haven't mentioned, which is Loving versus Virginia, a case decided in 1967 overturning Virginia's law passed the same day as the Virginia Sterilization Act in 1924, prohibiting people of different races from being married. And that law is overturned again in 1967. So all the eugenics cases that go to the Supreme Court talk about marital intimacy, they talk about privacy and reproduction, they talk about the state's power. And if there is any lesson to be gained from reading those cases is that it's a dangerous business to give the government power to decide who has children, who doesn't have children, who gets to decide. The government being in control of reproduction has given us some of the most shameful moments in Supreme Court history.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for joining me today. I also want to thank you for having written this book and particularly have taken the time to have updated it, because I think that as it presents in this new version, it really helps anybody who wants to understand why we're talking about the Comstock Act today, why it's still in many ways on the books, although it's been modified in some ways. And I want to thank you so much. We've been talking to Paul A. Lombardo. He's the author of Three Generations, No Imbeciles, Eugenics, the Supreme Court, and Buck v. Bell, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2022.